June 14, 1919. A muddy field outside St. John's, Newfoundland. The air smells like salt water and engine oil, and the particular kind of cold that comes off the North Atlantic, even in early summer. Two men in heavy flying kit are wedged into an open cockpit barely wide enough for the both of them. The aircraft ahead of them is a converted British heavy bomber, stripped of its gun positions, filled to the edges with fuel tins, and a handful of sandwiches and one flask of coffee. Behind them, across a patchy grass strip that barely qualifies as a runway, the Grey Atlantic waits. Their names were John Alcock and Arthur Whitten Brown, and in 16 hours and 27 minutes, they were going to change what human beings believed was possible. I'm Tail Dragger. You're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this story starts with a prize that sat unclaimed for 6 years and ends in an Irish bog. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up if you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, most people, when you say first transatlantic flight, they picture Charles Lindbergh, the Spirit of St. Louis, 1927. Ticker tape down Fifth Avenue, his face on every magazine in the world. And yes, Lindbergh was the first to fly nonstop from New York to Paris, solo. And that was a genuinely monumental achievement. Nobody is taking that from him. But 8 years before Lindbergh took off from Roosevelt Field, two Englishmen flew a leaky converted bomber across the Atlantic, and almost nobody today can name them. That bothers me. It should bother you too. Let me back up to where this story really begins. In 1913, a British newspaper publisher named Lord Northcliffe, who ran the Daily Mail, put up a prize of £10,000 sterling to the first aviators who could cross the Atlantic Ocean by air nonstop in either direction within 72 hours. £10,000 in 1913 was a life-changing amount of money. It was enough to buy a house, start a business, retire comfortably. The aviation world took notice. Then the First World War came and swallowed everything, including the prize attempt. 4 years of the Western Front rearranged everybody's priorities. But when the armistice came in November of 1918, the Daily Mail reactivated the prize. £10,000 was still on the table. And the world's aviators started showing up in Newfoundland. Why Newfoundland? Because the eastern tip of Newfoundland is the closest point of land in North America to the British Isles. From St. John's to the Irish coast, you're looking at somewhere around 1,900 miles of open ocean. That sounds like a lot in 1919. With the engines and navigation technology available, it was barely possible. Maybe impossible. By the spring of 1919, there was a genuine competition building on that Newfoundland coastline. The kind of competition that only happens when a large sum of money and a lot of aviation ego converge in the same muddy field. Harry Hawker and his navigator Kenneth Mackenzie Grieve had already made their attempt in May. They got about halfway across, had an engine coolant failure, and ditched in the Atlantic. They were presumed dead for 10 days before a Danish cargo ship that had no wireless equipment finally reached port and reported that it had picked up two survivors. The aviation world had essentially given them a funeral before the telegram arrived saying they were alive. That near disaster did not discourage the other competitors. If anything, it clarified the stakes. Freddie Rainham and his navigator crashed their Martinside on takeoff. The Handley Page Group was still preparing their enormous twin-engine aircraft and would not be ready for weeks. And then there was Alcock and Brown and their Vickers Vimy. John Alcock was a Manchester-born pilot who had been flying since 1910. Before the war, he had raced aircraft and set speed records. During the war, he flew bombing missions over the Eastern Mediterranean with the Royal Naval Air Service, raiding Turkish positions in the Dardanelles campaign. In 1917, he was part of a crew attempting to bomb Constantinople. His aircraft developed engine trouble, he was forced down over the Turkish coast, and he spent the rest of the war as a prisoner of war in a Turkish camp. He came home in 1918 with a stubborn streak that the experience had calcified into something close to iron. Arthur Whitten Brown was different. Scottish by birth, raised partly in Manchester, trained as an engineer and mathematician. He had served in the Royal Flying Corps as an observer, been wounded and forced down behind enemy lines, and spent his own time in German captivity. He was meticulous, careful, the kind of man who understands a problem from first principles rather than intuition. As a navigator, he was exceptional. The Vickers Company had sent the Vimy to Newfoundland specifically for this attempt. The aircraft was a twin-engine biplane that had been designed to bomb Berlin, a mission the war ended before it could complete. For the transatlantic try, Vickers stripped out everything that wasn't essential and converted the gun positions into fuel tanks. They loaded the airplane with 865 gallons of fuel. The two Rolls-Royce Eagle engines, each producing 360 horsepower, would burn through nearly all of it getting to Ireland. The cockpit was open, which is to say there was no windscreen, no canopy, no heated cabin. Two men in heavy leather flying suits and goggles exposed to the elements for however long it took. In June over the North Atlantic, that meant temperatures well below freezing at altitude, wind in excess of 100 miles per hour on the face, and whatever the weather chose to throw at them. They took off on the afternoon of June 14, 1919. The field was rough, the airplane was heavy. They used almost every foot of that Irish meadow getting airborne, and they cleared the fence at the end with what Alcock later described as not much to spare. But they were up, and they turned east. The first few hours were almost manageable. The Vimy climbed to a reasonable altitude, the Eagle engines settled into their rhythm, and the late northern evening light made the ocean below them look almost peaceful. Brown took celestial fixes when he could see stars or horizon, running the mathematics of dead reckoning and sun lines that had guided ships across oceans for centuries, now applied to an airplane traveling four times faster than any ship had a right to go. They ate their sandwiches, they drank their coffee. They talked when the engine noise allowed it, which was not often. Then, several hours out, the weather came. Not a gentle overcast. A wall, dense gray, wet cloud that went from their altitude straight up as far as either of them could see. Alcock flew into it and held his heading and trusted the compass. The Vimy bored on into the gray. The first thing to go was the airspeed indicator. Ice formed over the pitot tube and the gauge went dead. Without an external horizon and without a functioning airspeed indicator, flying in cloud becomes an exercise in controlled uncertainty. You hold what you believe to be the right pitch and trust your instruments and try not to think about the ocean below you. Then the radio failed. The generator that powered the wireless equipment gave out, and with it went any ability to send or receive signals. No weather updates, no position reports, no contact with the ships the Royal Navy had stationed across the Atlantic as relay points. They were alone, in the dark, in cloud, over the North Atlantic, with no airspeed indicator and no radio. And then the Vimy rolled into a spiral. Whether it was a gust, accumulated drift, or the disorientation that comes from flying, without visual reference, the airplane departed controlled flight and wound up in a steep descending turn. Alcock fought it. He got the wings level, found the horizon somewhere below the cloud base, and discovered they were uncomfortably close to the water. He pulled up, climbed back into the cloud, and kept going. Now here's where it gets interesting. The engines began to cough. Ice was forming on the carburetor air intakes. Both engines, real structural ice, building up in the intake passages and choking the airflow. An engine running lean from restricted intake air doesn't make full power. An engine with completely blocked intake air doesn't make any power at all. With two engines both icing over the North Atlantic, you are not in a good situation. Brown did something about it. He climbed out of the cockpit. In flight, over the open Atlantic. At altitude. In the dark. He worked his way out of his seat into the wind and crawled out onto the lower wing of the Vickers Vimy. He had a penknife. He reached the engine nacelles, one at a time, and he chipped the ice off the intake passages. Then he climbed back in, and when the ice came back, he went out again. He did this six times before Ireland appeared. I want you to hold that image for a moment. A man hanging off the wing of a biplane bomber, above the North Atlantic, at night in freezing temperatures, with a pocket knife chipping ice, then climbing back in and returning to his charts. That is what it costs to be first. By the time the Irish coast appeared out of the mist on the morning of June 15th, both men had been awake for the better part of a day, had survived a spiral descent toward the ocean, had lost their radio and airspeed indicator in the first hours, and had dealt with repeated engine icing that required one of them to physically exit the aircraft six times. Brown picked up the radio beacon from the wireless station at Clifton in County Galway on the western coast of Ireland. He told Alcock they were close. Alcock began looking for somewhere to land. They spotted what appeared to be a smooth green field near Clifton and made for it. It was not a smooth green field. It was an Irish bog. And it is in the nature of Irish bogs to appear perfectly solid from the air while being underneath the surface, deeply and enthusiastically wet. The Vimy's wheels sank the moment they touched. The nose pitched forward into the soft ground and the airplane came to rest, with its tail pointing at the sky and its propellers buried in the bog. Neither man was seriously hurt. Shaken, exhausted, cold through, but alive and intact. They had flown 1,890 miles. They had averaged roughly 115 miles per hour. They had burned virtually all their fuel, and they had arrived approximately where Brown said they would, which, given everything that had happened, is honestly remarkable. Local residents came running across the bog. A telegram went to London. Within hours, the news was spreading around the world. Winston Churchill, who was Secretary of State for Air at the time, presented them with the Daily Mail's £10,000 prize check at a ceremony in London. King George V gave them both knighthoods. Sir John Alcock, Sir Arthur Witten Brown, the newspapers called them heroes, which they were, and wrote their names in the same breath as the Wright brothers, which was also correct. And then 6 months later, on December 18, 1919, John Alcock was dead. He was delivering a new Vickers Viking amphibian to the Paris Air Show. He flew into fog and low visibility near Rouen in northern France. The aircraft struck rising terrain. He was 36 years old. He had crossed the Atlantic Ocean in an open cockpit biplane and survived, and then he died on a delivery flight to an air show 6 months after. Brown outlived him by 28 years. He never flew again. He went into industrial work, lived quietly, and died in 1948. There are accounts that suggest the loss of Alcock settled heavily on him. The two of them had done something together that neither could have done alone, and the half of the partnership that was still living had to carry that for the rest of his life. The Vickers Vimy they flew is in the Science Museum in London. The actual aircraft, battered and bog-stained, with the prop blades bent from the nose over in Galway, it's worth seeing. Here's what I keep coming back to. When Lindbergh flew in 1927, he had better charts, better weather services, a custom-designed aircraft built from the ground up for the mission, and 8 additional years of aviation technology behind him. That is not a criticism of Lindbergh. It is simply context. Alcock and Brown flew across the Atlantic in a converted bomber with instruments that iced up, a radio that failed in the first hours, no heated cockpit, and a navigator who hung off the wing 6 times in the dark to keep the engines running. They were first, they were extraordinary, and somehow history decided that Lindbergh's flight was the one worth remembering. I think they both deserve to be remembered, but today I wanted to make sure you know the names Alcock and Brown, and what it actually cost them to be first. Much of what I know about this flight comes from the Royal Aeronautical Society archives, and from John Grierson's writing on early transatlantic aviation. Good reading if you want to go deeper, find us at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. See you next time.